Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I had two options for sharing with you this morning. One was to give you five or six global trends, but as I reflected on it, my suspicion is that many of you have done a lot of reflection on missiological trends and developments. So I'm going to go for a more complex presentation because I think there will be some things in that will probably more satisfy you more than if I just gave five or six simple trends, which means you absolutely need a pen and a piece of paper or a computer to take notes, because I will speak faster as I go along, as Welshmen tend to do. Now, it was actually my idea and my responsibility to work at putting this document together. And it came as we discussed the preparation for the Cape Town Congress. I suggested to other leaders in the Lausanne movement that I don't think ever in the history of the church evangelical leaders have ever produced a document which brings together doctrine and praxis in one document. And it's my persuasion that in the New Testament, this is actually how Paul worked. So, for example, as I've mentioned in the introduction here, if you read Colossians, the first two chapters are on the supremacy and the uniqueness of Christ. And then in chapter 3, he switches his argument, as Francis Schaeffer says, to talk about spirituality with the kitchen sink. For the kitchen sink. In other words, if we believe these things, how then should we live? He does exactly the same thing in Romans, 11 chapters on the great doctrine of justification by grace through faith. And then in chapter 12, he talks about what are the implications, hospitality to strangers and things like this. So there's never any separation in Paul's thinking between doctrinal rectitude and convictions and praxis or application. That's why we decided to put together a document which brought together, we looked through all the major documents and councils in the history of the church since the first century and tried to think of how we could summarize what evangelical Christians have always believed about the gospel. When I use the word evangelical, by the way, I'm thinking of those whose aspiration is to have their lives and their convictions governed by Scripture. That's all it is. It's gospel orientation. It's an old word. It predates the Roman Catholic Church coming to existence. It was used in the debates with the heretics in 180 AD to describe those who emphasized authentic Christian living. They were called evangelical by some of the early church fathers. This is very important because many people in recent years, particularly in non-evangelical circles, have said of evangelical Christianity, it's really only a product of the Reformation. It is not. It is a term used before Constantine came to power, and that is very, very important historically in describing authentic Christian living. I wish there was more research and writing on that, because it would give dignity to evangelical Christians. As John Stott used to say, evangelical Christianity is biblical Christianity. Or we aspire to be biblical in our orientation. So we looked at the various statements, and Chris Wright came up with a brilliant idea for the first time in history, writing a series of doctrinal convictions in the language of love. This has never been done in history. That's the first half of the document. That's deliberate because many people resist doctrine, thinking it's dry, whereas, of course, in the Old Testament, in Moses' song in Deuteronomy 32, God says, "My doctrine will come to you like the rain in the morning, like the dew in the morning." In other words, the purpose of biblical truth is to refresh us spiritually, not to bore us. So that's why the first document is stating, this is what we have always believed, whatever our denominational affiliation, if we hold to be gospel-oriented people. But then the second half tries to answer the question, how then should we live missiologically in the 21st century? The first half of the document was written by six theologians from around the world. We asked different people, who would you like to speak into this? And we asked them to work at summarizing and crystallizing core Christian evangelical convictions over the 2,000 years that appear in pretty much all these documents. The second section, which is what I'm going to speak about this morning, is a summary of the feedback we got in Cape Town from leaders, from 197 countries. I don't think this has ever been done. And the question we essentially asked is, if we believe these things, what are the implications for mission in the 21st century? So we took all the responses from Cape Town. This was written up afterwards, summarizing what leaders from nearly every country in the world said are the challenges facing us. I want to give you a summary of 12 of the key challenges right at the end. But before I do that, I want to comment on the last 25 years, actually. I'm a bit computer phobic, so I have to work out how to use this. The growth of the last 25 years. My own background is I'm a church historian. And excuse me if I speak about church history a little in the next 40 minutes. But I think if we were to live for another 50 years and look back at the period from 1989 onwards, my own conviction is it is unprecedented in the history of the growth of global evangelicalism. There has never been at a global level such spectacular growth globally, not in Europe, but globally in terms of the growth of the evangelical church since the critical time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, which led to the opening up of, by my count, at least 30 to 40 countries in the world where gospel work was restricted. In our own ministry, that meant that IFES work grew from 100 countries in 100 countries to 150 in 12 years. It's not because of great leadership, but it's because we were living in a time when doors opened, not just in Eastern Europe and in Ukraine, where I was yesterday, but in Mongolia, in Nepal, which was very restricted, Hindu kingdom, in Mozambique, in Angola. So it wasn't just in a European context, it was a global transformation. And we saw the rapid growth of the church in various countries. Just recently I was talking with a Mongolian Christian and I asked him, please tell me something about the growth of the church in Mongolia. When I was on Operation Mobilization, just after I left university, I remember we used to have half nights of prayer, praying for Mongolia, and the thrill I experienced in the 80s of meeting one of the six known Mongolian Christians in the world who was converted through listening to radio ministry in Russian. And she was involved with her husband in Bible translation at the time. Well, today, so we hear there are perhaps 30 to 40,000 believers in Mongolia with in excess of 300 churches. This is unprecedented in history. This morning I had breakfast with the vice president of the Evangelical Alliance in Albania, who was converted in 1992 as a student. I remember praying for Albania before 1989 when there were perhaps three known Albanian Christians in one town and several living outside the country in Vienna and elsewhere, but no church to speak of. There are perhaps, he tells me, 10,000 evangelical Christians in Albania today. All that growth has occurred since 1989, speaking to Russian church leaders in a conference for 700 pastors in Moscow a couple of years ago. I asked them, how many evangelical Christians do you think there were in Russia in 1989? They said, we think there were 80,000. I said, how many do you think there are today? They said, we think 800,000. Well, I think they're probably exaggerating. It may be 400,000. But even if they're exaggerating, as sometimes evangelicals do, there has been significant numerical growth. The interesting thing is, when I asked them, why do you think it's arisen? They said it's because of the Ukrainians, whom Stalin forcibly moved here when he was in power. And there were simple believers amongst them, not university products. They were scattered all across Russia. They brought the gospel with them because there were more believers in Ukraine. After that era was over, post-Gorbachev, they planted churches all across Russia, and their impact was much deeper than all the Western evangelists who came in the early 1990s. And the interesting thing they said to me was this. All those years, we wondered, what is God doing, allowing our best people, including Ukrainians, to be sent to Siberia, some of whom never died and never saw answers to their prayers for liberation. We wondered what God was doing for 40, 50 years. Many of them died and never saw the answer. Those of us who are alive now in our 40s and 50s, we say, aha, now we see what God was doing. Behind the hand of a figure of power like Stalin, these people were brought into the country in sort of unconventional missionary terms, and God has used them to propagate the gospel across the country. It's become more difficult for Ukrainians now, I know. But this is an example of God's sovereign activity in the history, which often we don't trace unless we look back over decades or hundreds of years. Sometimes people don't see answers to their prayers early. Some go to heaven when the answers are not evident. But we see with the backward look of history what God has done. Now, if we ask which of the five largest evangelical churches in the world, in any nation, which five would you come up with? This is a good test for missiologists. Which of the five countries with the largest number of evangelical Christians in the world today? I'll give you one, USA. Okay, that's your starter. Who are the other four? Brazil is certainly the largest in Latin America and perhaps the fastest growing. Even the Roman Catholic Church in its statistics say that 400 people are leaving the Catholic Church and joining evangelical churches every day, apparently, the statistics I was given recently. It's the second country, Brazil. Third one was China, yeah. Tony Lambert is probably provided the best statistics in China Inland Mission or Overseas Missionary Fellowship. Through very careful analysis, he reckons there are about 60 million evangelicals in China. Some people say 70, 80 million. I would go for the lower figure to play it down. But it still beats Germany or UK, where it's maybe 1.2 million, or Romania or Ukraine, which is somewhere close to that. Those are the largest numbers in Europe. So it's pretty spectacular growth, especially since the Tiananmen Square massacre and afterwards, 1989 and thereafter, and the many Chinese students who've come to faith in Christ while studying in the West and taking the gospel back. That's three. Two more countries. Nigeria, yeah, is easily the biggest in Africa. Of course, one in five Africans are Nigerians. And the fifth would be India. I think the church in Korea is stagnating. It's not growing so rapidly. A lot of tension between leaders and Presbyterian leadership. Pyramidal system of leadership. Some people would argue influenced more by Confucianism than biblical principle, but that's a secondary issue. Many students and young people reacting against that form of authoritarian leadership. Small groups breaking out. Many young people leaving the pyramidal structured churches, becoming part of the smaller house church network, but the church not growing significantly numerically at the moment and experiencing some crisis. India would be the fifth country. Some people say 30 million evangelicals. It's difficult to quantify that. But there's no doubt in the last 20, 25 years that a lot of people, especially from poorer backgrounds, including those from the very poorest backgrounds, have been professing faith and trusting him. So very remarkable growth, and we could speak of many other countries in that respect. I was once with one of the great theologians from Sweden who taught in Uppsala, Agne Norlander, in Ethiopia, when he went there about 64 years of age. And I asked him to pray at a meeting which we had with African leaders. He started a prayer. I thought there was something different about his prayer. It wasn't like a cold New Testament sort of theologian. There was really life in it. I said to him, I hope you don't mind me asking, Agne, has something happened to you? He said, Lindsay, I've been touched by the revival in Ethiopia. He said, you have to understand what it's like to be in all these discussion groups in Sweden for 35 years, where there were five of us, two evangelicals, three liberals. We always lost whatever the discussion was about, whatever we said. Then he said, I've come to Ethiopia and there are many failings here, but I've been touched by the revival. He said, the last 5 years, we've baptized 200,000 people every year. He said, it's a time of spectacular growth. So Ethiopia would be another country, and we could mention others. Algeria, maybe 80,000 believers, 1,000 in the year 2000. Algeria, Tunisia, I just met with one of the leaders of the church there who told me she knows personally 200 Muslim converts. Still persecuted by her family. There were maybe 25 known Christians in Tunisia out of 6 million people in the year 2000, so there's been growth there. And of course, the Iranian church is experiencing spectacular growth. So if you look globally, there's never been a time like it in history. There are pockets of significant growth in that time in Europe, Albania being an obvious one, to some extent Russia and Ukraine, if you count them as European. But which is the country which percentage-wise has seen the most spectacular growth in evangelicals in Europe in 25 years? This will shock you.
France.
It is France. I worked in France, in Paris, for 6 years in the 1980s. There were 4,000 known evangelicals in the year 1910. In 1985, it was about 220,000. Today, it's 500,000. The difference is the church in France is mainly made up of lower-income folks, not so many university products working in the professions, like in the UK. So the criticism often of the UK church is it's strong in reaching middle-income professionals. That's probably because of the effectiveness of the student ministry, where the student work has not been so strong in France, but through the impact of the diaspora. So Philip Jenkins, the church historian and missiologist, says, through three factors, the charismatic movement, which has its strengths as well as weaknesses, which has introduced people to Bible study, the emphasis on church planting, which particularly was brought in by Mike Evans of OM in the late 1970s, early 1980s, which has been bought into by evangelicals across France, and thirdly, through the impact of the diaspora, which includes European missionaries, but also folks from Cambodia, Vietnam, Africa, the Caribbean, who have started many churches all across the country. That doesn't mean there aren't difficulties there, but there has been a time of significant growth in France in the last 25 years, almost imperceptible to the rest of Europe. And of course, there are still huge challenges in terms of the philosophical orientation of the culture. Very few Christian lawyers there, for example. We tried to start a national Christian fellowship for lawyers. 6 people came. And it shows how tough it still is in the country, but nevertheless, significant growth. Well, the whole lecture really could be about the growth of the evangelical church across the world. In the 1910 Edinburgh conference, there were thought to be 4 to 7 million evangelicals in the world. A conservative estimate, according to the World Evangelical Alliance, now is 300 million. I think it's probably more. And certainly well over half now are in the non-Western world. The other dimension is, of course, the growth of the missionary force globally. Huge increases in the number from Brazil's latest statistics I've got. 1987, 1,600 Brazilian missionaries in the world. 1997, 4,000. 2010, 9,000. 2015, anticipated 14,000. Historically, the move of missionaries from one culture to another occurs maybe 20 years after spectacular growth in the church. It's the last thing where you see the maturation of the national church. And that's why we're only just beginning to see the emergence of some significant evangelical statesmen globally, not yet at the level of John Stott and Billy Graham, but they will appear more in the next 20 years because it takes time for the church missiologically to grow and reflect in this area. But certainly the numbers are increasing and key leaders will emerge from those in coming decades. Similarly from Nigeria, Kenya, and so on. We have them now, of course, working in Europe as well as many other parts of the world. So that should, in many ways, I suppose, excite us. But just for your encouragement, of course, we struggle in the European context. I'll be giving a lecture tomorrow on understanding our European context, which is very complex, and how then should we work missiologically in Europe in a presentation tomorrow afternoon. But it is, in my view, having worked in IFS for this is my 40th year, and having visited over 120 countries now to speak at student groups, I think Europe is tougher than the Middle East. At least in the Middle East, people believe there's a God, whereas in most European campuses, you have to argue the case for the existence of God, so you're starting much further back. It's quite tough, which is why I want to give the rest of my life to developing a team of European university evangelists. But here are some external threats, despite the growth globally. I'll just mention 4, pluralism and relativism. John Stott was a great influence, not only in Lausanne, but in IFES. He was vice president for all the years I was general secretary. I remember going to see him just before he died, and I said to him, John, what do you think is the biggest challenge facing the global church? Straight away he said, number one, pluralism. The challenge to the uniqueness of Christ. And its first cousin, relativism, that all truth is relative. What surprised me was then he went on to say, the other thing that concerns me, this was maybe 5 years ago, he said, I'm really concerned about the growing threat of persecution that I see evidence of around the world. That was 5 years ago, that's point three, and that's accentuated. Now, the Times newspaper at Easter time 2 years ago produced a four-page spread on the persecuted church. I think they overstated the number of people persecuted. Sometimes the church is just restricted in what it can do. That's different from overt persecution. But nevertheless, we are seeing very significant growth in persecution. The Iranian church, the Eritrean church is amongst the worst persecution I've heard, and there's hardly anything about it in the Christian press. I talked with one Eritrean friend I've known for some years who was in Cape Town, and she said she sees her husband on average one night a month because he's traveling around keeping away from the police. And she said, Lindsay, it's terrible what they're doing. They're taking pastors, putting them in the front line of the war with Ethiopia, just like David did with Uriah. So they're the first who are killed. Then she said they put some of them in containers and bury them underground and they just suffocate. I've never seen that in any missiological journal in the West, but it just shows how awful the level of persecution is in some countries. And of course, you're seeing some of it in the Middle East and the North African context. It's increasing in India too, I'm afraid. And with the Indian National Party coming back into power, their influence was held back for 5 or 6 years, but there are already signs of significant extra pressure. Maybe more severe persecution will come, especially those who come from poorer backgrounds. The second, of course, is the growth of religious fundamentalism over the last 25 years. There was an American guy of Japanese origin in the early 1990s after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Can anybody remember his name? The End of History was the book that he wrote. Have you read it? Oh, it was a very influential. It made him a millionaire. And his thesis, and he's a professor now in one of the top universities, The End of History, you should have a look at it. It's a blockbuster in the 90s. And his argument was basically, history's over, the West has won. Democracy has triumphed. It was very simplistic, very naive, totally wrong. Many Westerners were totally taken in by it, including leaders in government. And then another one was written a few years later by Samuel Huffington called Clash of Civilizations. It was Fukuyama, F-U-K-U-Y-A-M-A, who wrote The End of History, Francis Fukuyama. Samuel Huntington III, I think he was, wrote The Clash of Civilizations, where he talked about the rising tension between the world of Islam and Christian and democratic traditions. And of course, we're seeing evidence of that more overtly in the last few years. The interesting thing is, when the Lausanne Congress took place in Manila in 89, that was the first Lausanne event I went to, nobody had any sense that the Berlin was going to fall, and it fell 2 months later. Nobody mentioned it at all. And there were some Russian pastors there. I talked with some of them, and Ukrainian pastors. I talked with some of them last week who came. But nobody had a sense of what was going to happen. Then, of course, the whole former communist world opened up. When we were in Cape Town, nobody had a sense of the Middle Eastern Arab Spring that was going to come so soon after. And we were so much for our prophetic voices. We were totally taken by surprise. So I don't know when we should have the next Lausanne Congress for fear of what other global events will occur afterwards, which will skewer our attempts to prophesy future developments. But the fourth dimension, of course, external challenge is hostile new atheism, which comes from Richard Dawkins and so on. There's a difference in this brand of atheism. It's unlike anything before. What Dawkins says is this. He said, when those planes flew into the Twin Towers in New York, it was almost like a revelation for him. I saw that all religions was not just false, but it had to be opposed. And I'm giving my life to opposing it because it's bad for society and people. That's different from saying, I just don't believe that God exists. That's going on the full frontal attack, and he's be responsible, of course, for crushing the faith of many simple believers as a consequence with some of his materials, which is partly why we started the European Network for European Evangelists, to answer the questions that students are throwing up in university. Actually, it's created more openings for us. Because when you tell students, don't believe something, they say, tough, I am going to believe it. So when they're told atheism is true and Christianity is not worth even reflecting on, they say, why not? I'm going to read the New Testament documents. And having been involved in student evangelism in Europe for 40 years, I don't think I've seen as much developing openness as I see in the last few years, for 30 years or so, since the mid-70s. And part of the reason is a reaction to that. Internal threats, ethnic divisions. Agne Nordlander said this in Ethiopia, despite the great growth of the church, the revival was being impeded by the fact that church leaders were trying to keep people apart ethnically and were opposed to inter-ethnic marriage, for example. Rwanda and Burundi, for example. Yugoslavia is another one. And this is why, missiologically, it's really important that the church and missiologists and preachers emphasize that one of the most radical things in the New Testament was that Jesus talked about a new community which was transcultural and multi-ethnic. It's really hard to develop a church. We have a number of Muslim converts, Hindu converts, and others in my home church, but it's really hard to develop a multi-ethnic church. But as soon as you start saying, as the church growth people did in the 1980s, that we should just form churches that are mono-ethnic, you castrate the gospel. I can't put it more strongly than that, because you imply, just because it's easier to reach people evangelistically along the lines of their ethnicity and language, we should just keep people in silos. But in the New Testament, what was really radical was that people like you and me were allowed to worship with Jewish believers. And if people in the first century had taught what the church growth specialist taught in the 1980s, you just reach people in their own group and you keep them apart, very few of us would have been here today. We would have been excluded from the gospel message that was coming in through these early Jewish believers. So it would be an interesting point for a debate. I'm sure that's woken some folks up, but I see no grounds in the Bible for a mono-ethnic Korean church or Chinese church, or dare I say a Welsh church. And interestingly, I was speaking in my own church in this context recently, and I said we have Welsh people have more in common with English believers than with Welsh pagans, at which point there was an ooh in the congregation. There are 800 people there. And afterwards at the door, an elderly lady whose husband was a great preacher who's in heaven now, she said to me about English Christians and English people in Z, I know you're right that we have more in common with English believers than Welsh pagans. It's just so hard to love them because of what they've done to us. And that's sometimes how people feel. But it is a biblical priority. And that's why leaders have to take the lead in saying, "This, we have to create new communities where God hasn't made me Welsh by mistake. I love my culture. I'm proud of it. But I think patriotism is okay biblically. I think nationalism is an idol. It often divides people, sadly. And our primary source of identity is not our ethnicity or our cultural roots, though they are very, very important. The primary source of our identity as believers is that we're in Christ. Lack of evangelical statesmen. As we were preparing for the Cape Town Congress, we decided we'd try to find one person in each country of the world who was a statesman, by which we meant somebody who's concerned for the advance of the gospel, no matter who is leading in their country. And so that they would find people from charismatic, non-charismatic, reformed, Pentecostal, Baptist, Anglican, no matter where, so that the whole church could benefit from the conference. In some whole countries, we couldn't find one person. And it was very noticeable because when these some folks were in charge of selecting people from their country, some would just choose people from their own denomination or their own church, including one very experienced leader in Lausanne wanted four people to come from his country from his own church. And I said, why are you doing this? He said, he came up to me and said, I'm so thrilled. There's four people coming from my church to the conference. And I said, well, there are not many more people coming from the country. I said, what you're doing is a scandal. Because you of all people at your age should be thinking, how can the whole church in my country be blessed by this? The mark of an evangelical statesman is twofold. First of all, he doesn't care who is on the platform. He doesn't have to be there himself. And secondly, when you're talking with him, it's hard to work out what he's doing because he's rejoicing so much in what God is doing through other people. So sometimes with these people, you have to say to them, after talking to them for 20 minutes, you've been telling me about what God is doing through this Mongolian evangelist or this Chinese preacher. Can you just remind me what you're doing? I haven't got that straight. Whereas most of us tend to just speak almost obsessively about our own ministry, our own mission agency. I think that's a mark of spiritual immaturity. And we desperately need people like Stott and Billy Graham and others, not necessarily of their stature, but who are just concerned about the advance of the gospel, not just their organization. The only reason I'm in IFES is because I think it's a good agency for propagating the gospel. My concern is the gospel. It's not IFES. And I think it's good for all of us to reflect, what drives my passion? Is it the agency I'm working for? Am I defending the agency? Or am I passionate about the advance of the gospel through whatever agency? The other is lifestyle failure, which John Stott argued in his last sermon was the greatest hindrance to world evangelization. And lastly, a quick summary. 12 of the major challenges that people highlighted coming out of the conference, missiologically. One, it's not one in terms of the most important, but the university world, because so many leaders come from that. Not so much in the business world as a result, actually. Not that many great business leaders have gone to university necessarily, but thought influencers. And I see many people I studied with in university who were currently in political leadership, and many of them in the top echelons of the BBC. I was in the same group with Tony Blair, for example, the director of British Airways, and so many others were students. Tony Blair used to come to one of our Bible study groups. And it just shows the possible impact of people when they're in that kind of age group. That's why Charles Malik, the one-time General Secretary of the United Nations, Lebanese, said, if you want to change the world, start with a university. Notice, historically, there's a very strong argument for saying that the Reformation started in the universities of Europe. Luther was converted as a young university professor in his late 20s in Germany. Calvin, in the Institute, says he was converted as a student in the University of Orléans. The gospel came, penetrated the universities in Northern Europe as a result of their preaching. So university world is important. But the converse of that is unreached people groups. Now, of course, this was a concept that was emphasized by Ralph Winter in the 1974 conference. I'm sure everybody knows about it. He said, up until now, we've all talked about reaching the nations, and we've thought in terms of nation states, which historically is a construct of political theorists in the last 250 years in Europe. In the Bible, when we talk about it, talks about nations, it's ethnic groups defined by their language and culture. And he said, if you think of the world in these terms, that means in some nation states like Nigeria, you might have hundreds of people groups, ethnic, according to the New Testament. Now, Paul Eshelman, in relatively controversially in his presentation in Cape Town, argued that there were 639 of these people groups in the world where there were 100,000 people who spoke the same language, where there has never been a missionary, where there are no churches or small groups, and they don't have the scripture in their language. So his point is, whether you agree with his statistics or not, why should we preach the gospel twice in some situations when many people have never heard it once? And he argued that the vast majority of the money that we spend in mission is spent on maintenance. And he said, we maintain too much and we pioneer too little. Now, it's very interesting that historically, since 74, this emphasis from Ralph Winter, the unreached people groups, it penetrated the budgets of churches all across North America. And many churches developed an adopt-the-people profile. It hardly touched Europe. It's not really influenced that much most mission agencies. from my observation over the last 40 years in Europe, some are beginning to think now of targeting people groups and challenging their church membership to think about penetrating those groups. Many mission agencies have just said, well, we've served in this country for 100 years, so we'll just carry on doing so. That's not necessarily wrong, but it perhaps shows a potential inflexibility faced with one of these missiological challenges in the world. Third is Bible translation. One of the great things about the Manila Congress in 89, which was perhaps less influential than 74 and 2010, was that all the Bible agencies, International Bible Society, United Bible Society, Wycliffe, and so on, they all met together in a private meeting and said, look, this is nonsense. We're all competing against one another. Some countries, we have two translations at the same time. Why don't we have an annual meeting of the leaders to decide which are the languages which don't have the scripture in their tongue, and then we'll share it out. They've been doing that every year for the last 23 years. And actually, the meeting of the Bible societies around the world is one of the best models that we can see of trans-denominational and trans-agency cooperation. And I think this is important because many people criticize evangelicals for being schismatic, and we start a mission agency at the drop of a hat. I remember Michael Griffiths in the Tamer Conference in 1977 when I was a student, haranguing people who had their stalls in the, which I thought were wonderful, but so many of them had five or six workers, and he said, you're all doing the same thing. That might have been a little bit harsh from the platform. But nevertheless, there are some good examples in the last 25 years of many mission agencies really trying to work harder. In Norway is an example, with Norma and so on, really trying to work at the idea of partnership together. The fourth would be oral learners, the direct opposite of the university world, the many millions who learn through visual or through listening rather than through textbooks or lectures or a university context. And it may be that sometimes those who emphasize the university world unwittingly miss out on the oral learners who learn through other means. Many mission agencies are doing much better in that respect. Fifth is diaspora or migrating peoples, where the church has come to us. It's a huge change in the last 25 years. I went to see Tom Houston, the former director of Lausanne, before I started working with, seconded from IFES to Lausanne. And I asked him, he's a great missionary statesman, he's in his mid-80s now, from Scotland. I said, Tom, what do you think, this would have been 8 or 9 years ago, what do you think is the defining or the number one missiological challenge or development in the early part of the 20th century? It was before the Cape Town Congress. He said this. The impact of migrating peoples, and of course it's on our televisions all the time. Now, that doesn't mean that European governments shouldn't have an appropriate immigration policy, which you have to have given that we are fallen human beings and we can't handle change, which is too rapid. So you've got to be realistic about how much change a home culture can handle in terms of migrating peoples. On the other hand, the Bible clearly teaches us that we are to love the Old Testament says, love the alien as you love yourself. And it is very interesting, for example, how many Chinese leaders and Iranian leaders back in Iran and elsewhere were converted as a result of Christians reaching out to them over the last 25 years. And many, many others from Vietnam, in a small coal mining town in which I grew up in at the end of the Vietnam War, we had 250 Vietnamese people turn up in our town because the government took people in. And it was one of the poorest towns in the whole of the UK, with 30% unemployment, highest number of single-parent families, highest number of people on social security, 4 programs on TV in the BBC in the last month on the poverty in that country, that town in which I grew up. And yet they absorbed 250 Vietnamese. And a local authority came to our church after 3 months and said, nobody else in the town is interested in these people except for your church. We put some money aside. You have it and look after them. Many of them became Christians because the church reached out to them. That didn't mean it was difficult. Actually, if you read the Acts of the Apostles, you're hard-pushed to name any people who became Christians at home. Very few. The Philippian jailer, starting with Pentecost, 18 language groups converted at the day of Pentecost who came from other parts of the Middle East. And most others, including Lydia, Cornelius, Paul himself, maybe Timothy was converted at home, but most others were converted away from home. And that says something about God's twofold strategy, one of which is to send us into the world, the other is to bring the world to us so that we can reach them. And even some missionaries we weren't anticipating, like Filipinos and Filipinas and others. I can tell you a wonderful story about that, but I don't have time. Number six is the growth of megacities, the thing that Tim Keller emphasizes. Megacities is a term that geographers, professional geographers, use to describe any city with 1 million population or more. In 1900, there were 11 of them. 1950, 83, 2,500. 3 years ago, the University of London put together a report called The Endless City, by where the author was Bosnian. His name was Judit Dudic. And he said, he talked about the endless city, and he said, the growth of the city is the only game in town. He said, at the moment, 50% of the world is in urban context. By 2050, we anticipate 75% of the world's population will be in the major cities, with all the implications for gospel witness. Four more to finish off with. Deeper discipleship, or the Christian mind. When we met with many mission leaders before the Cape Town Congress from around the world, we asked them, what do you think should be some of the key emphases of the conference? And I heard this term for the first time in my life. Several people, especially from Latin America and Africa, said, we think one of the emphases in the conference should be on deep level discipleship. I never heard of this. It sounded like deep level pizza. So I said, what do you mean? And the Latin American said, we're tired of more people going out the back door of our churches than coming in the front. That's what sociologists are saying. And that's because there's insufficient emphasis on making disciples in the churches. And the Christian mind, so a separation from Sunday and Monday, very rarely heard any theology of the workplace. The impact of prosperity theology, which is devastating many churches, large churches in Latin America and Africa, where people are over-promised what they will receive in this life. Again, I asked John Stott, what do you think is the theological weakness of prosperity theology? And you know, he was so brilliantly clear and succinct. He said, I think there are two problems with prosperity theology. The notion that if you're really God's, he will prosper you financially, and if you're a strong saint, you'll be healed of your diseases. He said, I think the two problems are a very inadequate theology of suffering, that actually it's one of the means by which the gospel advances. I'll speak about that tomorrow afternoon, some illustrations. And secondly, an inadequate eschatology, by which he meant most of the promises in the Bible refer to what we'll get after we die, not before. Well, you can debate that one. New approaches to Muslims, Hindus, and Buddhists. Many people say, and some books coming out just in the last 3 or 4 years are indicating more Muslims seeming to become believers in some places, like Algeria, Tunisia, Cairo. Leaders and churches there telling me great openness amongst people who are disillusioned with Islam because of the previous government. It's very interesting. They said, in the last 5 years, I said, what's your biggest problem? They said, one of them is, how do we deal with atheism? We've never had this before in Egypt. I said, what do you mean? We have Muslim atheists who are disillusioned with Islam because they're ashamed at what the previous government portrayed our government as, our country as, and people cutting heads off. And they're drifting. So in one of the big churches in the center of the city, they said, we have five people in the pastoral team. This was in June last year. They said, the last 4 weeks, we can't deal with all the Muslims who are coming to the congregation on their own in the morning just to find out more about the gospel. And not Christians aren't bringing them. They're just turning up. Nevertheless, we need to look at fresh approaches to Muslims, Hindus, and Buddhists. I don't know that there's one country where we can talk about a huge breakthrough amongst Muslims, and certainly perhaps even less so amongst Buddhists. And that is a missiological challenge facing us. Now, in the use of technology and media, including social media, is something people of my age are very poor at. I can't even work this properly. But I think younger people are helping us here to see that there are many wonderful ways of connecting with people through social media, but also through film, which we use a lot in university missions. And the example of groups like SAT7 in North Africa has broken up the ground for others who have subsequently been able to take the gospel in. And last one would be partnership without dependency. And this is a challenge for us who've been in mission work for many years. How do you work to a situation where there's genuine partnership, where you're leading, you're learning from one another, rather than creating long-term dependency? Many mission agencies, in my view, are doing better in this respect. There's more sensitivity, especially among some of the older ones, been around for a long time, who are showing great humility in this respect, in terms of how then should we live and fulfill God's calling to us in the 21st century. Yeah, well, I've spoken too long there, but let's have a few minutes for questions. I'm not... Isn't persecution always good at the end of the day? Do you want an honest answer? Historically, no. In some countries, the church has been virtually wiped out. Historically, back in previous generations, I think. And as I look at the situation, it's you have to take an historical perspective, which is sometimes 40, 50 years. If we were to look at Iraq at the moment, I would say probably unquestionably no. Because it's leading to many hundreds of thousands of Iraqi Christians, both nominal and real believing Christians, but many who are faithful, if I can say faithful in their nominalism, nevertheless holding firm, leaving the country, which is leading to a much smaller residual church in the country. And from what Iraqi friends tell me, nearly everybody's talking about leaving. Now, the story is not finished. I mean, the situation in Iraq is much more complex than that. If you include in Iraq the Kurds up in the northeast, there's no doubt that the events of the last 20 years, starting from Saddam's invasion of Kuwait and the restriction of his power before he was killed, have led to the opening up of the Kurdish people to the gospel, and mission groups like OM and others have actually done good work in planting churches in that region of the country. In some of the other regions, I would say things have gone back. In the West Bank, the church is much, much weaker than it's been in previous generations. I was talking with a friend from Nazareth last week at a conference in Germany. I've known him for 25 years. And he said, a few hundred believers now in Nazareth. It used to be a Christian town, but it's really, to all intents and purposes, Muslim. Same with Bethlehem. The number of evangelical Christians in the West Bank is much smaller. Who knows where things will go in the longer term? We're just not sure. I wish I could say that it is always the case that the church rebounds and grows as a result of persecution. On the basis of the evidence and stories I hear from believers around the world, I have to be honest to say I'm not sure. Within country, if you take the diaspora to be included, who are living outside and don't necessarily return for generations, if at all, then often, as people go to live in other cultures, escaping the tensions, you see many people becoming believers. And the Iranian church is the outstanding case since Khomeini's revolution in 79, I think there. But it's more complex. I wish we could always say persecution always brings...
Whether we understand it or like it is a different thing.
That's true if you take the example of the Russian church I mentioned earlier and the impact of Ukrainians, because many Russian believers told me we didn't see it. And some of our best men, they died not having seen it. And the persecution can have a cleansing impact. It's just there are so many... If you take the long-term view of 50 to 100 years, it's easier to see. But even then, there do seem to be some examples historically where the church nationally was crushed for centuries, maybe even in one or two places more than a millennium. And some of the people who escaped were a source of blessing in other nations as they were imbibed in them, like in North America, but not necessarily in the place in which they were born. If you take a view that ecclesiologically the New Testament talks about the church in two senses, the local church and the global church. And incidentally, that's another whole area for dialogue, because I find many people who emphasize the primacy of the local church, as with all these things which are a good emphasis, are so obsessive they can play down the global church. So sometimes folks who are really concerned about church planting in a locality and everything coming from there, they dismiss the work of trans-ecclesiastical missionary societies and refuse to work with them. So I've seen a number of churches in the UK say, well, in the New Testament, they went out from Antioch or elsewhere, we'll just send our own people out. We don't need OMF, or we don't need Interserve, or these groups. They're just artificial constructs. We'll do our own thing. And sometimes it's catastrophe because they haven't recognized some of these agencies. If they've been around for 100 years, they've learned lessons from failure often. So partnership is a better option. So I think we need to have this twin emphasis of the global churches and the local church.
So there are more dimensions to persecution. Yes, there are good benefits, but in a long run, it seems to be hurting the church more than benefiting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a question of at what point in history do we reflect. Of course, we believe in the sovereignty of God, which overarches all of history, including our lives. But within that sovereignty, some people are persecuted and they die. They don't see, they don't see the results themselves. So they go to heaven, and that's their joy. It's interestingly just.
And I think how much would you say that your country wise, at least now, seems to be an unreached continent or on its way to
yeah.
become it? How do you think about that?
Well, it's a mixture. I mean, there's an element of post-Christianity or post Christendom, and a return to paganism. There's a mixture of that. There's still a fair degree of nominalism. Europe is very complex, and it's very difficult in a conference like this. When we're asked, how do we reach Europe? I find it very difficult because there are over 40 countries, and each country varies even within country. I think it is, overall, the most difficult region of the world to reach. Personally, which is why I want to give the rest of my life to working in a European context. I don't mind if things go slowly and they take a long time. And we do need more people who put their heads down and work over the 40 years of their lives in some of these tough situations. I suppose the great advantage of when you pass 60, which I have now, is you see what God's been doing over 40 years and you hear stories. I mean, even just being in Spain for a youth missions conference 18 months ago. I was talking with a missionary friend, an American there. Oh, he's probably here. He's in his 60s too. And I said, there was 700 young people at a missions conference. And I said, people say Spain is a really hard country. But when you look at this, what do you think? I said, when did you come here? He said, 1980-ish. And he said, I'd never have believed this would happen in my wildest dreams. He said, I feel so excited. 700 young Spanish people come to a conference on Spaniards and mission. He said, the same thing in Italy, where I went to a similar conference to speak last year. Same thing with Mission Net and various other emphases. So there are some real pluses, I think, but it's tough. And I think our children, I'm not a prophet, but my guess is they're going to have a hard time unless we see a huge turnaround shortly and we build up people after us who are men and women of conviction and courage.
The number of Christian conversions can't keep up with the number of new Muslim babies being born. How are we supposed to compete with that?
I'm not sure it's a question of... it's not a question of competition. I mean, we can't be obsessed by numbers. I just go back to Jesus saying is that the way is narrow and few find it. And I think historically the church has always been a remnant or in the minority, and it always will be. And there are some countries, like I've mentioned, where you see significant growth. But there is no country in the world in history where more than 50% of the people were definite believing Christians. Jesus said we would be in the minority. The way is narrow, few people that find it. So we work for the growth of the church and we pray for it. But we understand that we're in a fallen, broken world where we have an enemy, there's hostility, and there will be persecution. There will sometimes be restriction. We should be thankful for each day we're not persecuted. And numbers will not always be stellar. We rejoice when we see the numerical growth. But at the same time, maturity, depth, and quality is another dimension of measuring the strength of the church, not just numerical. The last quotation from Peter Drucker, who was probably the great management guru of the last 50 years. Many people loved him. He probably became a Presbyterian Christian in the last few years of his life. One of my friends was his personal assistant, and she said to me the other day, you know, Drucker used to say, he gave a lecture apparently towards the end of his life where somebody was talking to him about the 100 top companies in the Western world. And, you know, the idea of top 100 countries sort of in terms of finance came in about 100 years ago. And he said when that came in, the initial top 100 countries, of those, less than 20 are still in the top 100. And he said there are two things that you seek for in an agency or an outfit. It's efficiency and effectiveness. He said many of these companies, they were efficient for 20, 50, some of them maybe for 100 years. He said, let me tell you an agency which is the most effective in history, but is unbelievably inefficient. It's something called the church. It's been around for 2,000 years. It carries on growing. It's in nearly every country of the world amongst people groups. It is effective in propagating its message relatively, but if you look for efficiency in terms of how it's run and its structures and its orders, then you'd be in despair and you'd think, how on earth is this carrying on? And the only answer is the providence and the goodness of God.
Okay.